Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the show we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And we have a website for the program, which you can find at radioinvivo.net. You can access all of our past programs on that website. And after a little more than a year and a half of doing the show, there is now 55 hours of programming available. So if you have a little time to spare, it's all on there. And we are adding to that all the time as we feature a wide variety of topics here on the program. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and it will take you right to the site, and you can subscribe. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well, and that's at communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And if you're interested in NESENT's work about evolutionary synthesis, the New York Times ran several articles yesterday about the state of the art in evolutionary biology, and I would certainly recommend you check those out. Very well done. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, which is at www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to be discussing biofuels, as you might have heard a minute ago when the Home Power Hour gentlemen were on. We're taking a page from their book today. And there is a lot going on right now in North Carolina with regard to this alternative source of transportation fuels. Here in the Triangle, the North Carolina Biotechnology Center has taken on a leadership role in this arena, and they recently were involved with the production and release of a document called Fueling North Carolina's Future, North Carolina's Strategic Plan for Biofuels Leadership. And joining me to talk today about this strategic plan in detail and the many challenges and opportunities presented by biofuels is Jason Nelson. Jason is the Biofuels Project Coordinator for the Strategic Plan Project at the Biotechnology Center. Jason is a native of Roxboro and received his BS from North Carolina A&T and a Master's in Public Administration from American University in Washington, D.C. Jason, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you for having me, Ernie.
Let's start at the beginning. Where did this Biofuels Strategic Plan Project come from?
Well, if we go back to the very beginning of the strategic plan, we would have to go back to June of 2006, when a biofuel summit was brought together at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. It brought together roughly 15 state academic and corporate leaders with a focus on state planning around biofuels and biofuels policy.
I see. And how were the participants selected, and who were some of the participants?
Some of the participants included a number of people from the Biotechnology Center, some participants from the General Assembly, as well as Novozymes, who was very active in some cellulosic technology, moving us towards kind of a second-generation ethanol. Some of our universities were represented with academicians and researchers, primarily in agriculture, agronomy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Jason, I'm going to want to drill down into the plan itself in some detail. But why don't you start us out by kind of giving us a broad overview of this plan, which was released on April 1st, if I'm correct, right?
Oh, yes, it was. Stepping back a little bit, after the biofuel summit in June of 2006, that actually spurred a Senate bill, or catalyzed some legislation out of the Senate. That was Senate Bill 2051. And that really brought about the creation of a strategic working group that ultimately put together the strategic plan for biofuels leadership. And in that legislation, it called for five co-convening organizations to really rally the troops around what needed to go into a strategic plan for possibly implementing a biofuels industry in North Carolina. As named in the legislation, four of those co-conveners are the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, the North Carolina Rural and Economic Development Center, North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University in Greensboro, as well as North Carolina State University in Raleigh. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, the Secretary of Revenue was added as a fifth co-convener, Secretary Norris Tolson.
It's funny you mention his name, because just to show that we're up on the breaking news, he's about to be your new boss, isn't he?
Yes, actually, effective, I think, July 2nd, he will take over as president of the North Carolina Biotechnology Center.
Which has been a kind of open job for several months now.
Yes, he's been serving in an interim management capacity for a number of months.
I see. Well, congratulations on getting a new president.
Oh, thank you. We're all very excited and look forward to working with Secretary Tolson.
Indeed. To get back to the strategic plan, I'd like to just quote from the plan itself, the goal, mm-hmm. which I thought sums up exactly what's going on here quite effectively. And that goal is to develop a liquid biofuels industry that is substantial in output, agriculturally and economically important, sustainable, and significant across the state. That kind of says it all, doesn't it?
It really does. And part of our mission with the strategic plan and the strategic plan process was to think broadly and to think strategically, recognizing that we have a number of resources and capacities in North Carolina from Murphy to Manio, and how to best capitalize on those resources to get us from the field to the pump.
And the whole idea here, as mentioned in that goal, is that the plan really is to develop this as an industry for the state itself.
Yes, because looking at this comprehensively, as I said before, from the field to the pump, it involves so many different dynamics. The field aspect, identifying feedstocks, identifying farmers to grow those feedstocks, identifying and developing capacity to produce and distribute those fuels, developing the infrastructure, a significant amount of research and development at looking at how to best harvest, store, and process those feedstocks for a number of fuels. And then ultimately, how do we get it to the pump for the use by consumers?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting that this has come about, because it does seem to be a natural for North Carolina itself. We have the agricultural capacities, many of which are in a transition state, and a lot of the farmers in the state are looking for new cash crops to be able to take advantage of as we, you know, make this long transition out of a tobacco economy. We certainly have the scientific firepower well at hand, and a state government that is sympathetic to new initiatives like this, such as the Biotech Center. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. And I think when you lay all of those elements out on the table, it's very easy to see why an initiative and why a strategic plan like this makes so much sense, because we do have so much going for us. As you mentioned, a number of communities around the state, some of them tobacco communities, some textile communities, have seen the landscape of their communities change because of perhaps some industries moving out of state or out of country. And with that goes a lot of its economic base and the loss of a lot of jobs. So one of the interesting elements about looking at a biofuels industry in North Carolina is recognizing that from a rural perspective, we have an opportunity to really awaken and revitalize a number of these communities, with farmers looking at new crops to grow and potentially communities in a position where they might be able to produce some of their own fuels.
That would be very interesting, wouldn't it? Yeah. One thing I noticed in the plan that was very specific is that it does not call for the use of corn. The targeted feedstock crops, according to the plan, include canola, switchgrass, hullless barley, coastal Bermuda grass, industrial sweet potatoes, whatever those are, and miscanthus as strong possibilities. Along with animal waste, algae, forest-based resources. It seems like every day I'm seeing a new a story about a new technology for feedstock production, including one right here at North Carolina State that says they can take virtually any kind of feedstock and turn it into jet fuel.
Yeah, it's really interesting, a lot of the research that's going on. One of the things we recognized when we were all brainstorming over the strategic plan, there was an early recognition that in North Carolina, we cannot build a viable industry, and specifically as it relates to ethanol, based around corn.
Mm-hmm.
The Midwest has done it, and they're doing it relatively well. It's because they have the infrastructure and the capacity to grow and process and harvest a lot of corn.
Sure.
Although we grow corn in North Carolina, it should be noted that we actually import a significant amount of corn that is used in this state, a lot of which is used for animal feed. So with that recognition early on, it really opened the door to exploring new opportunities and new ground, no pun intended, for farmers and for communities all across the state. And also within that is the exciting opportunity that our state is so diverse in terms of its land and its soil and its synergies. Things that we can grow very well in Western North Carolina, we can't necessarily grow well in the Piedmont or on the coast, and mm-hmm. vice versa as you move across the state. And for example, on the coast there are tremendous opportunities to do things with algae. So one of the things we're also doing is, while we say we can't really focus on corn, we do recognize that we can really maximize some of our opportunities if we tap into many of the regional and local resources and capabilities that are there to help us as we look to implement a biofuels industry in North Carolina.
And how has the agricultural community been responding to this? I mean, obviously they have their eyes open. They're seeing what's happening out in the Midwest, and corn farmers are suddenly getting wealthy again.
there's a lot of excitement. We've received a lot of positive feedback, and a number of these farmers are telling us and telling some of those who were involved in the process that they're ready to hit the ground running. Mm-hmm. And with some of these crops, it's going to take some more research and development to determine the best crop rotations, the best soil conditions, the best time of the year to plant and to harvest it. So with a number of the crops that you mentioned, and there's such a laundry list of crops to explore.
Sure.
But as we continue to explore those crops, there are a lot of elements of research and development that have to go into issues around growing and harvesting before we can have our farmers start growing new crops for fuels.
I see. What kind of timetable are we looking at as far as that goes? Because there are existing crops that are ready to be churned up and mulched and turned into fuel now, right?
Oh, definitely. within that, there is this concept that we need to start looking short-term, mid-term, and long-term as we look mm-hmm. at feedstock development. And in the short term, we may have to rely, if we're talking about ethanol production, I should say, we might have to rely on some corn for early production. But keeping that in mind, we have to look at what are our midterm and long-term goals and how to best identify the crops that will get us to producing or meeting our 10% goal over the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the industrial...
What is that goal, by the way?
Oh, the goal is actually kind of the thrust of the strategic plan. It's strategy number one.
Mm-hmm.
And simply... it's by 2017, 10% of liquid fuel sold in North Carolina will come from biofuels grown and produced within the state. And we like that goal because it is very bold. And it's bold because we aren't only talking about producing the fuels in North Carolina. We're also talking about growing the crops that we use mm-hmm. to produce those fuels, which is really significant.
Right. So no longer relying on so much on foreign oil or even domestic oil. It'll be a homegrown industry if it all comes to pass.
Oh, definitely, because I think that issue of dependence really brings up why or how a lot of the conversation in North Carolina and also nationally started, recognizing some of the changing dynamics of the world that we live in with increased population growth and demand on the current fuels that we have. If you look at growing in emerging economies like India and China, as well as population growth estimates in the United States, it begs the question, you know, are we going to have enough fuel? Because I always like to think of it as we have an economy as it relates to transportation fuels that runs primarily on a non-renewable source of energy. So, and not to get into a conversation about peak oil or what day we might run out of fossil fuels, it does beg the question, whether it's 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, at some point we're going to have to address this issue of transportation fuels and energy sources being derived from non-renewables.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to start addressing the issue of how are we going to compensate for the increased demand around a limited amount or a limited supply
sure.
of energy.
Oh, that's a big issue and a big debate at this point. Well, I've heard, Jason, that North Carolina has actually been referred to as the Saudi Arabia of biomass. What exactly does that mean, and what is the potential economic importance of all of this to the state if everything you're talking about becomes a reality?
I think that really goes back to an earlier piece of our conversation today when we talked about the number of different types of crops we can grow mm-hmm. in North Carolina and the different climates that we have in which we can grow all of those crops. It just creates an environment that lends itself very nicely to targeting a wide array of crops. The list that you mentioned earlier, for example, I could probably call a number of researchers within the next couple of hours and potentially double that list. And all of those crops or plants can be grown and grown well in North Carolina. But I think what we have to also recognize is just because we can grow all of these crops, it doesn't mean that they are the best sources for producing the fuel.
Right.
Some might provide more energy than others. And
is that how it's measured in energy per acre yield? Or
yes, that's one of the measures a lot of scientists use. So mm-hmm. when you're looking at a multitude of crops, it's one of the things to take into consideration is we have this per acre yield, how much energy will this crop give us versus crops B, C, and D? And
mm-hmm. sure.
we have to really target the yield per acre when identifying the best crops to grow in North Carolina.
And does this, given that these would not be food crops, does this have any benefits potentially in terms of, increased sustainability, reduced need for pesticides, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think what we have to focus on, from beginning to end or throughout the entire continuum of the process from the field to the pump, we have to act under an umbrella of environmental stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's very important to recognize that biofuels in North Carolina and the concept of producing our own fuels, it's a way of doing what's right for North Carolina and doing right by North Carolina. And that involves, involves so many different things, but it really looks at, yeah, we can grow all of these crops, but can we do it sustainably without robbing and cheating the environment and repolluting the environment?
Right, right. Well, that's certainly going to be vital to success of a plan like this, I would think. Well, Jason, to whom was this plan formally delivered as of April 1st? And what happens now? Are any of these provisions we're talking about binding in any way at this point? Or is it more like a roadmap for potential legislation and appropriation as we move forward?
Per the legislation, the Senate Bill 2051 from August of 2006, we were mandated to produce the final strategic plan and deliver it to the Environmental Review Commission of the General Assembly. And the Environmental Review Commission is a joint committee of House and Senate members. It's a non-standing committee. And we delivered a formal presentation, I think it was April 3rd of this year. It was well received. We received a lot of positive feedback, not only from the members of the Environmental Review Commission, but from a number of the members of the House, both the House and the Senate, as well as community stakeholders statewide. From there, there were a couple of the strategies or a number of the strategies that required some legislation.
Sure.
One of them was creating the Biofuel Center of North Carolina, and which perhaps we'll get into later when we discuss the specific strategies. Mm-hmm. But one piece of legislation creates this statewide nonprofit entity, coordinating entity. And another piece of legislation also creates the Biofuels, North Carolina Biofuels Campus in Oxford, North Carolina. And so where we are at this point is we were introduced, both of those, actually, the Biofuel Center, we requested, there was a $5 million budget request. So we made it into the House budget. Unfortunately, we did not make it into the Senate budget. And right now, we are in the conference process. So any day now, we're expecting the final budget. And I'm optimistic that we will receive some funding for mm-hmm. this endeavor.
Well, I'm sure they're going to hear this, and that's bound to put it over the top.
Oh, I certainly hope
Thanks
so.
Thanks to your articulate presentation.
Oh, thank you.
let's do talk about the nine strategies that are involved in the plan, because there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. We talked about the first one, which is the goal of having 10% of the liquid fuels sold in North Carolina mm-hmm. coming from biofuels grown and produced in the state by 2017. And you just mentioned the second one, which
yes.
is the statewide biofuels commission.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently that's looking at about $500,000 annually to fund that. What do they envision there? What would this commission have the authority to actually get done?
Right. Well, going back, with all of these strategies, our ultimate goal was to answer that one question of what combination of vision, policies, and resources is required for North Carolina to develop a liquid biofuels industry. And we've already discussed the first two strategies. Strategy one being the 10% goal. Strategy two, a statewide biofuels commission. We realized that there needed to be some sort of coordinating entity that was responsible for guiding and overseeing the state's sustained, very high-level and policy-based biofuels initiative over time, and ultimately the implementation of the strategic plan, because we wanted to work for a continued and steady movement for getting us from the field to the pump. And a number of ideas were tossed around. You know, should it be another state agency or a state commission? Should it be a private nonprofit corporation? And at the end of the day, what we settled on was a private nonprofit corporation holding up a couple of different institutions as prime examples of how this can work and how it can work well. And they both happen to be co-convening organizations of the strategic plan, mm-hmm. the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, which was which was really started through legislation and various strategic thought processes over 25 years ago with Governor Hunt. And also one of the examples I love to use is the North Carolina Rural Economic Development Center, which is based in Raleigh, North Carolina, and headed by the magnificent Billy Ray Hall. And again, that's another statewide organization, private nonprofit corporation, receives state funding, and they really do serve a role of coordinating policy and advocacy, implementing funding opportunities and programs, and really representing and serving a cause and meeting a need of constituents and services that have been identified are vital to the present and future of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. So I think when we hold those two organizations up as an example, it makes sense of why a private nonprofit corporation like the Biofuel Center of North Carolina is especially critical for instituting programmatic services, funding research and development, being an advocate for policy and incentives, mm-hmm. and moving biofuels to the marketplace, because ultimately...
And communicating with the public.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the Biotechnology Center is a perfect model for success. That has been a new industry, relatively speaking, in North Carolina,
exactly.
and a highly successful one. Become very important economically.
Mm-hmm. And simply put, what we're proposing to do with biofuels in the Biofuel Center of North Carolina is exactly what many state leaders years ago proposed that we do with biotechnology in the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. Mm-hmm. It's about economic development, it's about research and development, it's about public awareness, and it's about bringing together public and private partnerships.
Right, right. So the model, the template is already there, yeah. and we know it works. That's going to be great. You are listening to Radio In Vivo on WCOM, and my guest this morning is Jason Nelson from the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, and we are talking about the recently released strategic plan for the development of a biofuels industry in North Carolina. And Jason, I don't know if we need to necessarily talk about each one of these strategies in detail, but it's very interesting how it all fits together, yeah. and does look like so much like what has been done with biotech and microelectronics is another
yes.
example, going back a little further, perhaps. What kind of investment are we looking at in terms of our hard-earned tax dollars going towards this?
It's hard to say exactly what type of investment across the board would be needed from the state. Obviously, some investment would be needed.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a tremendous amount of work, both from the public and private sectors, that have to look at a number of things. I think we did earlier touch on the feedstock issue when you look at growing and harvesting various types of crops. There's also production and distribution. And currently in North Carolina, all of the biofuels production that we have is in the biodiesel community.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to take every opportunity I have to applaud them because they're doing tremendous work at the local and community levels.
Absolutely.
And aside from the production, there's also the distribution issue. There are some difficulties with certain types of fuels that pose a bit of a problem in terms of distribution and getting fuels from point A to point B. And we have to continue to look at not only that production side, but that the distribution piece of how we ultimately get it to the pump, because there are some areas that definitely need some work there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to have to come from, I think, both the public and the private sectors. It's going to have to be spurred from investment dollars from both ends. And more than anything, I think one of the things that we've kind of been a cheerleader of or public-private partnerships of having opportunities where we bring the public and private sector together for things like research and development and production and distribution.
Right. Well, the production and distribution arms of this are interesting and almost
possibly
seem like
the biggest hurdles.
Yeah. Exactly. What is envisioned in terms of the distribution? Are we going to be able to go to the corner Exxon station and there will be a biodiesel pump or an ethanol pump Are the petroleum companies going to be playing along with this?
Oh, the petroleum industry question is a really good one. But in terms of what we envision, there are a number of exciting visions out there. There is that notion that perhaps within a 50-mile radius one day, there will be a biorefinery that produces fuels from crops grown in that region. That's one of the more exciting visions. I like this idea that literally I could go 50 miles in any direction and have a significant portion of my transportation fuels made. Right now, I guess the question of, you know, will I be able to drive around the corner to the Exxon station and or Chevron station or BP station and, you know, fill up with a biofuel? Certainly that's the hope one day. And if you look at the 10% goal, what we envision is at a minimum, all of the fuels that you pump into your car are at least contain at least 10% of a biofuel grown and produced in North Carolina.
I see.
I think perhaps part of the a part of public awareness within this question is that we can't just put 100% ethanol into our automobiles. The biodiesel is a little different, but with ethanol, right now, if you wanted to use what's known as E85, which is a blend of 85% ethanol and 15% petroleum-based gasoline.
And that's the most common blend in use at this point, right?
That's a relatively common blend. Mm-hmm. In order to use that in an automobile, you have to have what's called a flex fuel vehicle. And not every automobile manufacturer makes an E85 vehicle. Mm-hmm. And also coupled with that is
the current vehicles, you could not use that.
Right. Fuel. For example, I drive a small Scion compact and I can't put E85 in my car. Mm-hmm. However, all automobiles can run on what's known as E10. And E10 is simply a blend of 10% ethanol and 90% gasoline.
And 10% is what we're after, right?
Exactly. The only thing is, not every pump or tank has E10 in it. In North Carolina, to my knowledge, there is no labeling program, so there wouldn't be a sticker on the pump that says you're getting E10 in your tank. A number of other states in the Midwest with tremendous capacities in the ethanol industry have various labeling programs. So when you pull up to the pump, you know you're getting an E10 blend. For example, when I filled up this morning, I possibly could have gotten an E10 blend or some blend lower than E10, but I have no way of specifically knowing that. And if you look on the biodiesel side, most automobiles I think it's after 1994, don't require a complete overhaul or retrofit of your diesel engine. You can run various blends of biodiesel. So I think that is one clear advantage on the biodiesel side, because you don't have to have an automobile whose engine is built specifically for running a particular type of fuel. And that's part of the problem on the gasoline and ethanol side, is you can only use an E85 pump if you have a flex fuel vehicle. And then here in the Triangle area, there are only a handful. Actually, it may not be a handful. I know of one, maybe two stations that sell E85. So that just goes to show you some of the strides and hurdles that we have to overcome and getting blends like that to consumers.
So it sounds like there's a little bit of a chicken and egg syndrome.
Exactly.
Going on here.
It's like it begs the question, why would I buy a flex fuel vehicle if there is no if I can't get the fuel at my local gas pump? And then on the other side is, well, I'm not going to put in the gas pump if there aren't that many flex fuel vehicles on the highway. So there is that chicken and egg argument that goes back and forth.
And that may be where this public-private partnership comes in to break that logjam. Okay. Jason, this sounds like a terrific plan.
Thank you.
All good. I'm keep looking at it and can't quite figure out where the downside is. I'm sure there's one somewhere, but isn't this really a pretty significant turnaround from where we stand right now? You know, I understand that even today, North Carolina is actually one of the leading producers of biofuels, thanks to the several startup producers around the state that you lauded quite appropriately. But there are actually right now several disincentives presented to biofuels production and use. Tell us about this $2,000 bond required of small producers, and it also seems like there's kind of an antiquated and unfavorable tax environment for these people. Is that part of the initiative here to kind of clear out some of that stuff and clear the tracks to get this going?
Oh, definitely. I think part of that involves a lot of public education, not only of consumers, but also of some of our state legislators about what's actually on the books and what opportunities are available to consumers as well as producers of biofuels. As it relates to the bond question, without getting into the specifics of tax and revenue law and state revenue code,
mm-hmm.
What comes into play there is that every time you and I go to the pump and fill up our cars, within that $2.85 per gallon is a.
Where did you buy gas for $2.85?
I think I may have paid less than $2.85.
Oh,
actually.
My goodness!
But within that per gallon charge is state road tax,
right? Which in North Carolina are pretty high,
right? We have one of the, from what I'm told and from some of the research that we've done, we have one of the highest road tax and fuel taxes in the country,
mm-hmm.
and I think it should be noted, and this is neither a plug or an endorsement of the State Department of Revenue or the State Department of Transportation, but I think it should be noted that we do have the second largest state road system in the country behind Texas. So I think that does help answer perhaps why our state road taxes are so high.
Yeah, well, we're known as the good road state.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think when you look at the issue of the bond, part of that really affects a community that's out there that produces their own fuels, some of whom literally produce it in their own backyard, some of whom have mm-hmm. retrofitted engines where they can go to Costco or, you know, any other supermarket and actually buy vegetable oil and run their engines on vegetable oil. Well, when you do that, obviously you aren't pulling up to the pump and you aren't paying a road tax.
Right.
So whether you believe the road tax is right, wrong, or indifferent, there is that real disconnect between people who have taken advantage of the opportunity to produce their own fuels and mm-hmm. I guess in some sense become self-reliant. There is that disconnect between them and our tax infrastructure.
But yes, obviously that's true. But there was the story that came out within the last couple of weeks about this fellow in Charlotte mm-hmm. who spent $1,200 to convert his diesel Mercedes to run on vegetable oil and was all proud of it and had bumper stickers all over mm-hmm. it and, you know, a real enthusiast to the cause. And he was fined $1,000 by the state on this very issue about for not paying motor fuel mm-hmm. taxes. And is probably going to be fined another $1,000 by the federal government. And he's going to have to put up this $2,500 bond, apparently, just to be able to use his vegetable oil legally. You know, that was, I thought, kind of a embarrassment to the state that situation came about, because these people aren't tax evaders, you know.
I think we're at a point now where it would really behoove a lot of people to sit down and review what laws we have on the books and how they impact communities like that, because I think there really is a miseducation and perhaps lawmakers not fully understanding this concept of literally making and producing your own fuels.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there some of the legislation that's being considered right now in the General Assembly does away with some of this stuff, does it not?
Well, yeah, actually, in this particular long session, there have been a number of biodiesel and biofuels related legislation. And again, making the argument for the Biofuel Center of North Carolina and a coordinating kind of public policy advocacy organization in that regard is having kind of a voice out there that will help create a sense of cohesion with legislation, because there was some confusion amongst a lot of us out there who are reading the legislation, working on the legislation, and bills just kind of popping up left and right. And there was a tremendous amount of confusion on the part of not only lawmakers, but those of us who have been involved in the policy process. Mm-hmm. So it would certainly help to have some sort of guiding voice to help navigate us through the policy process, what incentives make sense, which incentives don't make sense.
Right. And that's really what it's all about, is it not the whole issue of incentives?
Yeah.
So where does all this morass of legislation that you mentioned, I saw the rundown and my eyes got kind of glazed over just reading the list. There is a lot of activity right now, which is a good thing, I would think, but I'm sure it will all, you know, filter out mm-hmm. into something that will actually happen. Where does everything stand right now, and what's your assessment of the progress in terms of the legislation and policy?
Comprehensively, it's hard to tell exactly where we are, because I think some of the legislation required budget action and some did not. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, it's a little challenging to capture all of the legislation. I'm optimistic that we are making strides in the right direction. I think as we move closer to larger production capacities of biodiesel and perhaps ethanol, that we will move much closer to much more substantive and substantial pieces of legislation, more perhaps on the production and distribution side, because right now a number of those elements aren't there, so I think those issues haven't been addressed. So mm-hmm. there's an opportunity to start being proactive with legislation and looking at where we want to be strategically 5 years, 10 years, 25, 50 years, and what tools do we need to put in place now to make that happen.
Do you think there's been an advantage here? I'm sure a big part of the production of this strategic plan and this whole idea is aimed at those legislators, because they're going to be the ones who are going to have to sign off on putting up all the seed money for all of this. Which, just to return to that, I think, according to my notes, the kind of grand total proposed, at least, was about $25 million to get all this off the ground in comprehensively, which, you know, as in my reading, did not sound like a whole heck of a lot of money. That sounded pretty modest compared to the potential return on that investment. But I guess my point is, given the visions we've talked about previously for biotechnology industry, microelectronics industry, that, you know, there is this track record of success with this kind of thing in this state. Do you think maybe it's going to be a little bit easier to get all this up and running in terms of the legislature in North Carolina than it might be elsewhere in terms of educating these people mm-hmm. as to the possibilities?
Oh, I definitely think so. And with any budget issue, there are always competing forces of education, health care, and universities, community colleges. And I think what we have to do is, one of the hurdles we have to certainly cross is really getting a number of more facilities online in terms of production and actually breaking ground and having the production output there to prove that we have the ability and capacity to produce biofuels on a substantial scale in North Carolina. And I think if we can cross that hurdle, that it will start proving in a sense that perhaps we're worthy of larger investments. Because I think if you look at mm-hmm. other states around the country, Florida, a number of states in the Midwest, New York, are throwing tens of millions of dollars. Tennessee are all throwing.
Georgia's.
Yeah, Georgia. And when I say tens of millions, $40, $50, $60 million. And a number of those states are just pouring buku amounts of money into research and development mm-hmm. and some aspects of production. But I like to think we took a step back and looked at almost every step of the continuum from the field to the pump and really started to think about strategically, what do we need to do? Because if we're going to build an industry and a viable industry and a sustainable industry, we have to address all of those elements from the beginning of the process to the moment it goes into your gas tank.
And comes out the tailpipe.
Exactly. So, I mean, that said, we have taken a much more strategic look. So it may not, and although the plan calls for, I think, comprehensively $25 million plus, we realize that not that $25 million is not necessarily needed up front.
Sure.
There are some pieces of the plan that require legislation and require funding as initial seed money, so to speak. But collectively, the strategies do not require funding, that amount of funding up front. And I think that's a very important recognition to have is, although we're asking for this or targeting this lump sum of money, we aren't looking at it as if we need it now to make it all happen.
Right. That
now.
Was at least over what, 5 years?
I think definitely so. At least over a minimum of 5 years.
And given a state with a budget in the several billions of dollars at this point, again, that seems like a very modest amount of money.
Oh, certainly certainly modest. But again, you go back to the budget and the policy process, and there are so many competing forces for those billions.
Jason, what are the potential environmental benefits that could come out of this? Let's fast forward 10 years from now, and assume that this has all come to fruition. Are we looking at environmental benefits? Is it kind of
certainly there.
Okay,
these fuels, biodiesel, ethanol, and a number of the other potential fuels are all cleaner burning fuels. They're biodegradable. They're made from plants, crops, animal fats, so they don't pose a number of the emission problems and environmental problems that we are currently facing with the use of petroleum-based products. So head above shoulders, that is, as I see it, the primary benefit of, on the environmental side, of using or implementing biofuels.
What about given, you know, the current concern about carbon emissions and carbon neutral is a term we're hearing a lot in terms of global warming. I know that this is a topic of great controversy globally, that in perhaps not in the U.S., but in other areas in the world where biomass production is taking hold in a big way. It's having a real negative environmental impact. I saw you had Doug Crawford Brown on your panel, who is the climate change or a climate change expert at UNC, and we had him on the show last year to talk all about that. What was his take on that particular issue? Was that voice heard?
Oh, certainly. We had a number of environmentalists and environmental organizations who were involved in the process, including the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, the Southeastern Alliance for Clean Energy, as well as a number of other groups. And I think really when you look at issues around environmental sustainability, environmental stewardship, when you start looking at places like Southeast Asia, for example, that is a huge producer and exporter of palm oil, which is used to produce biodiesel in some parts of the world. Right. There's a lot
That's really the problem crop.
That's a huge problem because there's a lot of deforestation that goes into growing of the palm trees and then cutting all of the palm trees down to harvest the oil, and significant amounts of deforestation. And some of those issues have also popped up in Brazil with their use of sugarcane for the production of ethanol. It's interesting, you can read various sources and see various footage that as they have made their commitment over the last 30 years to move towards ethanol in producing it from sugarcane, many have said that in order to meet their growing need, they're going in and also getting involved in some deforestation efforts so they can plant even more sugarcane. And I think more than anything, like I said earlier, I think we have to operate under this umbrella or banner of environmental stewardship. Just because we can produce the fuel in North Carolina doesn't mean that we should engage in the process if it means the detriment of our environment, if it means the pollution of our air, our streams, our soil. And we really have to take that into consideration when we look at targeting certain feedstocks and the overall production of biofuels. Even though it is a cleaner burning fuel, it has to be a clean process, again, from the field to the pump.
I see, and that has received a good deal of emphasis, I
yes.
assume. Jason, before I neglect to do so, where could listeners go to get a look at this strategic plan? It is available online.
Yes, it is available online. It's available on the website for the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, mm-hmm. and that web address is www.ncbiotech.org. That's www.ncbiotech.org.
Right, and the link is quite prominent to the strategic plan itself, right there. It must have been quite a relief to finally get that done.
Oh, it was. It was approximately 7 to 8 months of...
A lot of meetings, I imagine.
A number of meetings and discussions about public awareness education, policy incentives, research and development, feedstock development, and biomass, mm-hmm. and how to best coordinate an effort around all of this. So it was a really exciting process. And perhaps the most exciting for me was working with the over 70-plus individuals from the private sector, like Novozymes, located in Franklinton, mm-hmm. and Lotus Engineering, who is the automobile manufacturer who is looking at creating a number of flex fuel sports cars. We worked with universities, North Carolina A&T, North Carolina State University, some researchers from Appalachian State University in Boone. I mentioned some of the environmental organizations earlier. We worked with state government, the State Energy Office, Department of Administration, mm-hmm. Department of the Environment and Natural Resources, the Department of Agriculture, and just really people who were not only engaged, but very interested in thinking strategically around the concept of biofuels and bringing and building and implementing an industry in North Carolina.
Right. Well, that must have been very exciting because, you know, your description of how multidisciplinary and multi-stakeholder the process was.
As I've been told, it's like herding cats, so I guess I have a new talent of herding cats.
I wanted to ask you, Jason, about one more potential downside to all this, because there are obviously challenges. But we've been hearing a lot recently about... the situation in the Midwest, mm-hmm. Where this has been such a success, actually, there's been some unintended consequences. Corn prices have been going up quite rapidly. A lot of the corn farmers are getting a lot richer than they ever used to be. But that is also putting a lot of upward pressure on food prices, not only here, but elsewhere, you know, with the tortilla riots in Mexico because the price of corn is going up so rapidly. Is there any concern that cut kind of scenario could play out in North Carolina?
Possibly. And I think that's one reason why we really wanted to target, both in the midterm and the long term, of identifying feedstocks that would not pose a threat to food sources, and especially corn.
Mm-hmm.
And the corn debate is interesting because for every story I hear about corn's impact on the price of tortillas in Mexico or rising food prices here in the state, you read you can find an article that says, you know, some of those concerns are invalid. So I think more than anything, in North Carolina, we just can't do it with corn.
Right.
And fortunately, we've identified and continue to identify feedstocks that don't pose a threat to food sources, whether they be for humans or whether mm-hmm. they be for our poultry or swine industry.
So what's your favorite feedstock? If you were going to invest in a feedstock that's ready now?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. Do I have to pick just one?
You can pick a couple.
Okay, I'll pick a couple.
You can pick a whole portfolio.
Okay, a portfolio. I like that. I would definitely look at, and only because I was at a very interesting conference on Friday in Boone at Appalachian State called Science in the Mountains, and there was a researcher there from North Carolina State University who's working at the Fletcher Research Station, and he's doing some wonderful work with Miscanthus, which is...
Now, what is Miscanthus?
It's an ornamental grass.
Okay.
And he's working on a number of varieties, but he's also and it's interesting because the work he's doing is looking at it as how to maximize its potential as an ornamental grass and to get it to grow a certain height, for example, if you wanted to plant it in your backyard. But he's also working on varieties that could grow as high as 15 feet tall that would be ideal for the production of biofuels.
Well, my backyard already looks like that.
Maybe you should start making fuel in your backyard. Only I suggest that $2,500 bond. Others, I'm intrigued by the industrial sweet potato, only because as a true North Carolinian, I love sweet potatoes.
Sure.
So there are some researchers
now,
at
what,
NC
what is
State,
an industrial sweet potato?
I'm told...
Is it just not tasty?
I'm told is it basically has no taste or has a very horrible taste because its intent is not to be eaten. It's to be used for industrial purposes.
Uh-huh.
There's also work being done...
Oh, and we're already the number one producing state of sweet potatoes.
Exactly.
Right?
So, you know, and that's one of those perfect examples of identifying something that as a state we're already very good at doing, and how can we capitalize on that even more than we already are.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, what else? There's algae.
Algae's going to be big if Craig Venter gets his way.
Yes.
and
there are,
produces the bacteria that will spew biofuel
exactly.
out.
Exactly. Some of the numbers on, and I don't have them committed to memory, but if you look at the acre per yield on algae, it's astonishing when you compare it to a number of the other potential feedstocks. And mm-hmm. From the research that I've done, it's very clear that there's that we know we can grow algae, and we know on at least on a pilot scale that it can produce a lot of oil.
Sure.
But we have to cross that hurdle into actual deployment where we can identify the best way to, you know, break down the algae and extract the oils. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm really excited about.
I'm sure people
about.
Are working on that.
Oh, yeah.
Speak.
And there's a lot of work being done here, not only in North Carolina with some of the marine science and marine biotechnology in the southeastern part of the state, but mm-hmm. also a number of other states are doing a tremendous amount of work in algae. So I would say, so to cap off my portfolio, I would use algae.
Okay. And we'll check back in 10 years and see how you did. Well, Jason, has the drastic increase over the last couple of years in gas prices and other petroleum-based fuels, has that had an impact of making all of this, the biofuels initiative, more economically viable? Has biofuel suddenly become more competitive with the price of gas going up so high?
I think so. I think what we have to look at in that regard is, without getting into a long conversation about incentives and how to really make it work.
Sure.
But there is that question of what happens when the price of biodiesel or the price of ethanol starts fluctuating at a point where it may wind up being higher than the price of gasoline. And that's because as long as it's lower than the price of gasoline or traditional diesel, then those two fuels remain very attractive and very competitive. But what happens if they start spiking above, for some reason, above mm-hmm. Current baseline or current averages? So I think as long as they remain truly competitive when they're priced below gasoline and diesel.
Sure, sure. Well, I know it's much the same issue with things like solar, as my colleagues on the Home Power Hour spend a lot of time talking about, that these economic models have to make sense for these things to be implemented.
And there's and perhaps I'm getting off topic, and I apologize if I do, but also I think coupled with that question of economics is some of the things that are going on politically that have driven us to this point. In large part is that question, it's looking at decreasing dependency on foreign sources of oil. And if you look at what's going on globally in places like Nigeria, in Venezuela, and throughout parts of the Middle East, areas around the world that have incredibly huge oil reserves, if you look at what's going on there, that's driving, politically, that at least is driving a lot of interest in the area, because there's a real push around national security mm-hmm. to reduce our dependency on foreign sources of oil. So whether you agree with that argument or not, you can't deny it makes a wonderful argument for moving towards creating fuel in our own backyard, so to speak.
Absolutely. Well, with that quite eloquent statement, we are literally out of time for the hour, Jason.
That was a fast hour.
It goes quickly. Jason Nelson from the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, thanks so much for taking the time to come in and share your thoughts about the future of biofuels in North Carolina.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.